there, and welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical news, entertainment, discussion, debate, dialogue, answers to your emails, and a lot to do about healthcare and science in the news. Yes, it's another hour of Ask Dr. Dawn, and you're very welcome to be here. Before we begin, however, we have to say that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I want to start off with a little bit of a commentary. Let's just talk a minute about the latest in healthcare. The Senate is currently debating, and for those of you who haven't been listening, and I think it's a growing number of people who are wanting to focus elsewhere, but this is important. Stay with it, folks. Come on. Latest idea that Harry Reid has floated is that under the agreement, people ages 55 to 64 could buy into Medicare. Now, of course, we don't know what that would cost, and we can pretty much assume that there would be serious adverse selection, but then that's kind of a backdoor way into a public option. And at this point, I'll take any door, back door, side door, through the skylight, whatever we can get, because we have some serious things coming along that it's important that we understand the implications. Just to put it in perspective, Medicare spending, just without an expansion, in the next 10 years is expected to jump from $45 billion to $171 billion, just taking care of diabetes. All right, so over the next couple of decades, everybody who's now 50 will be 70, and everybody who is now 30 will be 50. And at the rate of increases, we can anticipate that there will be 44 million diabetics in 2034 at the current rate of increase. Now, that means more than 10% of the population will be diabetic, and that's an expensive disease to manage. Furthermore, a recent study, this came out, I'm quoting Health Day News, December 2nd, published in the December issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, looking at current trends in smoking and obesity, and it basically said that for all of the advantages and improvements in life expectancy and cancer that we've achieved by getting people to stop smoking over the next 20 years, the number of people who've become obese are going to cancel that out. Before very long, there won't be a net gain, there'll be a net loss, even though people have quit smoking. Now, this is a good number. If all Americans quit smoking and controlled their weight, the average person would gain 4 years of life. I like that statistic. It sort of plays it out. Now, why we need a public option more than anything else has nothing to do with the individual uninsured person, really. It's a more deep social issue. If we have a public option, then the government has an interest in changing society. And the only people who can really change society are the government. Think about 20 years ago. You could smoke in the movie theater. You could smoke in the restaurants. There weren't any funny announcements on the side of cigarette packages. And over the last 20 to 30 years, there have been fundamental social changes, all mandated by government. Maybe they were local ordinances. Maybe they were the Surgeon General. But ultimately, governments have taken the lead in making it so inconvenient to smoke that it's become socially unacceptable. Now, that's a really good thing. I'd like to see that happen with fast food. I'd like to see that happen with Krispy Kreme drinks. I'd like to see people take a look at that concept and feel the way that they feel about somebody smoking in the presence of their child. I'd like people to look at other people's dietary choices as a social decision that's going to have an impact on their pocketbook, because it is. I'd like people to demand bicycle lanes. I'd like to see people demanding the opportunity to exercise. I'd like to see an exercise facility at every large business. You know, give them a tax deduction if they maintain a gym in the basement. this is the sort of thing that government can and will do when there's a financial reason to do so. So we need to set up the incentives correctly so that government assists us all in finding ways to exercise and finding routes to healthy food and not making it so darned difficult. I still can't believe they put soda machines in the school. It boggles my mind, but that's another diatribe. Let's talk to Frank in Salinas. Hello, Frank, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a problem with when I sleep at night on my shoulders, especially the left one. Not the right one's not nearly as bad. It hurts enough to keep waking me up whenever I turn over, and on my shoulder primarily. I can do the plank on my elbows, and I can put my hands out straight in front of me and raise them up, and it doesn't hurt. But if I put them out to the side and raise them up, that's when it really hurts. The left one is much worse than the other one. Mm-hmm. I've had x-rays, and they don't see anything that should be causing this kind of thing.
Is there a place on your shoulder that you can touch with your hand that is sore?
There are certain muscles right around between my chest and my shoulder, and sometimes in the back, if I reach up behind my back and push, I can find spots that are painful.
Okay. Well, the most common cause of a pain like you're describing would be either a bursitis or a tendonitis. When you're upright and not lying on the shoulder, are there any motions like reaching above your head, or if you take your left shoulder and reach over the top of your head to scratch your right ear, will that hurt, for example?
I did have physical therapy, so I do, before I get up in the morning, I'm putting my arms way up above my head as far as I can. It doesn't seem to hurt.
So I'm thinking that this is probably not a call where I'm going to be able to give you a diagnosis, because there's too much involved with a hands-on exam. I'll just tell you my approach to a shoulder pain is, first of all, I palpate three places, one behind the ball of the shoulder, one right at the top of the shoulder bone on the side, and in the front where the biceps tendon is. And then I have the person raise their arm out to the side, kind of like the flapping motion you would make if you were flying.
Uh-huh.
And I have them do that, first of all, to see how high they can take it themselves, and then how high I can take it. If they can't get all the way up, then how high, if I get them to relax, which is hard, they can get it. And then I give them some weight and have them resist. And if the pain is triggered by any one of those motions, then that suggests something called impingement, shoulder impingement. So I suggest that you go to, do you have online access?
I don't, but I can find someone that can.
Or else go to the library, because all the libraries have free internet. And look up shoulder impingement, I-M-P-I-N-G, impingement. Try that as a first step and see if the symptoms they describe seem like they match with that. Okay, sometimes physical therapy, in my practice, I've noticed not all physical therapists are created equal, not all patients are created equal, and sometimes the first time someone gets physical therapy, it does nothing because they haven't quite identified the area that needs to be targeted. So don't give up.
The strange thing is that I think it's in the muscles more in my left arm.
You know, Frank, I'm not going to be able to help you with this on the air. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You can come see me, and I'll try to examine you.
Okay.
But Salinas isn't so far from Santa Cruz.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Let's talk now to Jerry in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jerry, and welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Slept well last night.
Good.
Right around Thanksgiving, I developed a late-night cough, a real violent cough. I was not sick before at all. It only comes up when I lie down late at night. I was at a friend's house, and I took a nap the other day in the afternoon, and it came up a little bit, but, there wasn't a problem. I've started taking codeine cough syrup.
Is that helping?
Well, it's interesting. I take it, and it does help. It does help a lot. But I take this one teaspoon when I go to bed, and I'm guaranteed to wake up an hour to an hour and a half later coughing some more. So I take a second teaspoon there, and then usually I sleep through the night. But the last few days, I've started even waking up at 4 in the morning, and the cough just is a really violent cough. There's nothing I can do about it.
Mm, okay. Well, a couple
things. Never productive.
You've got a very classic case of tracheitis, and the way I diagnose that is you don't cough except when you lie down.
Uh-huh.
And when one lies down, I'm sure you've heard of sleep apnea. Well, when you lie down, the tissues in your throat tend to sag a little bit in the direction of gravity, and the membranes on the sides there of the tube touch each other, and they're on a hair trigger. They're very highly sensitized because of probably a viral infection, although I will say allergies with chronic post-nasal drip and sometimes acid reflux can also mimic this, so there are other possibilities. But whatever causes the irritation is irrelevant. Once you have it, when those tissues touch, they trigger a cough response, and it's a nagging tickle cough, and eventually you sort of exhaust the cough response, and maybe you can get to sleep for a couple of hours, and then it recurs, and off you go in this horrible loop. Some people are more prone to it than others. And the fact that it gets better with codeine is a good indicator that that's what it is, because codeine is an excellent suppressant of this cough reflex. So other things that can be helpful are lots and lots of moisture. So humidifying the air in the bedroom, making sure that you're really well hydrated. And by that, I don't mean drinking a liter of water 5 minutes before going to sleep. I mean staying hydrated throughout the day, because the moisture of the tissues, the more mucus, and the mucus acts as a kind of a barrier. There are a couple of herbs. Horehound is an herb that is what they call a demulcent. It coats the mucous membranes and, again, encourages more mucus. I'm very fond of having people sleep on a wedge pillow so that they don't lie flat, and you try to keep the tissues from opening up as much. So if it's possible for you to sleep in a 40, 30, or 45 degree, depending on your bed and your tolerance for that, that might be very helpful once the cough starts. You know, if you wake up at 4, you could just wedge yourself up on a reading pillow and see if you can just doze for a couple of hours. It will fade eventually, and there's no real problem with using the codeine to suppress the reflex until it does. There is another agent called Tessalon Pearls, T-E-S-S-A-L-O-N. That's a pharmaceutical that is a cough suppressant. In my clinical experience, I found that it is variably helpful. Some people get nausea from it. Some people get complete relief of their symptoms. So it's worth a try if the codeine just isn't doing it for you.
Okay, thanks.
This too shall pass, my friend.
This too shall pass?
This too shall pass.
I'll call you when it's done.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. We had an off-air question. I recently started eating potato chips with Olestra. What do you think about Olestra and side effects? First of all, Olestra is a doctored fat. It's a frankenfood. And so you always have to be concerned about frankenfoods in the sense that maybe they're not as easy for the body to deal with. Olestra is supposed to be non-absorbed, which is a very good thing, because who knows how the body would detoxify something like this. And I do discourage Olestra in people who have lots of food sensitivities, because I have a feeling that they don't have such a good mucosal barrier system, and that they may actually be absorbing some of this molecule. But for people who don't otherwise have GI problems, don't have irritable bowel syndrome or a history of colitis in their past, for example, then I think it's reasonable to use small amounts of this if you're trying to avoid the extra fat hit. Like, let's say you have an elevated cholesterol and you're trying to reduce your saturated fat, fried potato chips, bad. In general, I discourage the use of frankenfoods. Olestra does have the problem that it depletes your body of certain vitamins, the fat-soluble vitamins, and I'm not at all sure what it's going to do to your gut flora, and I have great confidence that this has not been studied adequately, because it's not recognized by the FDA as an issue. So therefore, the drug companies and food companies don't have to show that there's no injury there, but I'm fully convinced, and I think there's enormous amounts of scientific data that you really shouldn't mess with your gut flora. So in summary, I guess I would say, why don't you just not eat potato chips? If you must eat potato chips, I would rather you ate potato chips than potato chips dipped in frankenfood. And I guess that answers your question. Sorry, it wasn't more favorable. Let's take a moment and go to some emails. We had a lot of good emails in the last couple of weeks. This one from Kate in Santa Cruz. A couple of weeks ago, Dawn, you mentioned CoQ10 for patients on Coumadin therapy in a dosage of 150 milligrams a day. I actually think that was for statin therapy, Kate, but going ahead, Kate says, I've had open heart surgery, valve replacement, aortic repair, and I was interested in taking CoQ10, so I contacted my doctor because of the Coumadin Clinic asked me to confirm with her first. The doctor had said since the FDA had not approved this supplement, she had no dosage to recommend other than take one pill daily, which perplexed me since she didn't ask the milligrams of my pills. Do you have any resource I could present to her to help her make a decision for me? Well, Kate, I'm afraid that your doctor was playing a little bit of defensive medicine there, and so I don't know that you're going to have an easy time of it getting her to give you a firm milligram recommendation, but that's okay, because this is a nutritional supplement, and I have a way around that. In general, people who are not on statins can safely take 50 milligrams a day. It's probably beneficial. It's definitely not harmful. When you get to higher doses, say the 1,200 milligrams that are typically taken by patients with Parkinson's disease, we still don't see adverse effects beyond GI intolerance, but the data isn't as deep or as long. On the other hand, if you're helping your Parkinson's disease, you've got a favorable risk-benefit ratio. But when you're taking something just as a nutrient, as a supplement, 50 milligrams for non-statin users, 150 to 200 milligrams for statin users is a widely acceptable standard. And I do believe that if your doctor went to, say, scholar.google.com or Wikipedia or even eMedicine and searched the topic, she might find a lot of resources. I just don't think that she wants to be on the lawsuit if something happens to you and you decide to make a claim that it was a Coumadin problem or a nutritional problem. And I understand defensive medicine because we live in an insane culture that sues doctors for stuff like that. So you may never get a straight answer out of your doctor for something like that. And I'm sorry that that's the case. But honestly, I think you can take between 50 and 150 and feel pretty confident. You can look at your blood levels. We do know what the blood CoQ10 levels should be. So hopefully the two of those things will help you figure out how you're going to proceed. Another email from Georgia in Atlanta. I love your show and listen to it every week. I'm a 24-year-old female in good health, not on any medication. I exercise 3 to 4 times a week, eat a diet primarily of fish and vegetables. I work in a sushi restaurant and take a daily multivitamin. My question is, for the past mornings, when I wake up, my right hand will be numb or tingling for about an hour, sometimes more. Sometimes will start after I get out of bed and is unchanged by switching sleeping position. It never happens after the morning. Any thoughts on what could be causing this? Well, Georgia, I'm wondering about carpal tunnel syndrome. That usually happens at night, and when we sleep at night, we tend to flex our wrist, which squeezes the nerve that runs through the middle of our wrist, the median nerve. So people will wake up with numb fingers. Sometimes they'll be painful and even wake them out of sleep. It does tend to get better when you straighten your wrists out. But your comment about a sushi, working in a sushi restaurant and eating a diet of fish, did make me want to suggest that you have your doctor order a urine mercury, not evoked mercury, but just a mercury level, and see if you're putting out above the middle of the quote-unquote normal reference range of mercury in your urine. You probably won't be toxic by toxicology definitions, but anybody who's got any kind of nerve tingling issue and eats a lot of fish, I do ask them to check a mercury level just to see what their dietary mercury is doing. Sometimes if it were, say, an 8 or a 9 when the reference range is 0 to 10, I'd go off the fish for a few months and see if you are possibly accumulating a little bit of mercury from your diet. This will tend to be worse, by the way, in people who have fillings, mercury amalgam fillings. So as such things go, a little bit of extra advice, but you might try just getting a simple carpal tunnel splint and sleeping in it for a few weeks and seeing if that helps with the morning tingling. Let's go to a live caller, and that is Julius in Los Angeles. Hello, Julius. Welcome to the show.
Do you know about a male version of the quinacrine or quinacrine, I'm not sure how to say it, treatment? Do you know about that?
A male version of the quinacrine treatment? No, give me a hint. What are we treating?
It's like a vasectomy, only it's not surgical. On a woman, they take this chemical and they seal up one of the tubes in her vagina to prevent pregnancy.
Right. That, I believe, is the Escher procedure.
Ah, is that what they call it?
I think so, yes. So this is an ablation, a chemical ablation. If you're injecting, the trick is to get into the right spot.
Right.
No, I'm not familiar with that at all. Are you a regular listener?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So what I'll commit to do is I will commit to look it up and speak about it next week. So we're.
Can I call you back about it next week?
You could absolutely call me back about it next week, and I promise to be ready.
How about the IntraVas device? Have you heard about that?
Yes, a little bit.
I'll call you about it next week.
Sure. The Holy Grail is reversibility, and the IntraVas is trying for that. Okay, I'll talk with you next week. Gary in New Hampshire writes, can you help me offer a little emotional closure relating to my father's death? 3 years ago, my father passed away unexpectedly. He was 67 years old, and as far as we know, he'd been healthy. He'd taken a week off from work at that time for what he thought was a pulled muscle in his neck. But during the course of that time, he became very agitated, had significant abdominal pain, couldn't eat, and became jaundiced. Not a pulled muscle. He finally conceded to let us take him to the hospital, which parenthetically, folks, tells me that this was a healthy guy as in hadn't been to see a doctor in years, unquote. Upon testing, suddenly a surgeon appeared before us with the startling news that my dad likely had advanced cancer and that he needed an ultrasound and a liver biopsy at once. But what that tells me is that his liver enzymes were very elevated and that he had evidence for a serious dysfunction. The next day, a surgeon performed the biopsy, which was reported as fairly routine, but within hours, my father had died from what was said to be uncontrollable bleeding in his belly. When the surgeon spoke to us later, he said my dad's liver was 95% gone and that likely dad had been cancer-ridden for some time. Unfortunately, my mother would not allow an autopsy. Final tissue tests did reveal a squamous cell, small cell cancer from the liver that had likely originated in the lungs. We also learned that the ultrasound done in the hospital revealed the presence of an aortic aneurysm. Although my father was reportedly healthy, he had quit smoking 8 years preceding his death upon being diagnosed with glomerulonephritis. That resolved after a few years of prednisone, but from that point his doctor kept a close eye on him. Okay, I take it back. I guess he was seeing his doctor. In fact, he had a physical a few months before his death, during which his abdomen was palpated. I wonder if he was heavy. Anyway, I understand that small lung cells are notoriously sinister, but even his primary doctor was astonished by this events. Is it likely the aneurysm burst and could thus explain such a hastened death? Or is there such a thing as a liver that just gives out so acutely? Well, a liver giving out to the extent that it would cause that kind of rapid death from bleeding would have to be in a person who really didn't have any platelets or blood clotting factors. And the hospitals are extremely careful about doing biopsies on people with elevated liver enzymes whose clotting factors haven't been checked. So I don't think that the biopsy was the proximate cause of death. Obviously, I am just looking at the chart and thinking aloud here. The other thing is, if the aneurysm did rupture, that could certainly account for a rapid exsanguination, which sounds like your father's end course. And in a way, that's probably one of the best and most merciful deaths that he could have undergone, given the clinical situation. I don't think, from what you're saying, that the bleeding to death was due to his liver disease, but it may very well have been due to his cancer, since cancer does definitely change your body, and all it takes is for a cancer to erode into a blood vessel. Plus, as you said, that aneurysm may have let loose. It sounds to me like it would have been much easier to accept if your father had done all of this at 87 rather than 67. At 67, vigorous, still working, no one really expected this, and it is very difficult to recover from that sudden swat of the universe that you describe. But nothing you've said here strikes me as being in any way fishy from a medical standpoint, so I hope at least this commentary will help you let go of that aspect. Could it have been different? Did someone screw up? No, I honestly don't think so. Let's take a moment and explore some stories that came up about exercise. I'm associating a little bit off of some of the earlier things that we've talked about, particularly the story that came out earlier this week about how New York is running into problems trying to encourage bicycling. Exercise can benefit men with prostate cancer. This was a study done by, chief investigator is Stacy A. Kenfield of Harvard School of Public Health. And they found that in a study looking at 2,686 men with prostate cancer, followed between 1986 and 2008, okay, 22 years, that's good, The men who engaged in physical activities equivalent to jogging, biking, swimming, or playing tennis for half an hour per week, not so much, had a 35% lower risk of death from any cause and a 22% reduction in risk of death from prostate cancer, and that is statistically significant. Walking, men who walked 4 or more hours per week compared to those who walked less than 20 minutes per week, had a 23% all-cause mortality. And of course, if you walked 90 minutes per week at an easy pace, if you walked 90 minutes per week at a normal or brisk pace, you had a 51% lower risk of death from any cause. So vigorous activity was the best. 5 or more hours of vigorous activity a week, it was 56%. 90 minutes per week of brisk walking was 51%. So that's the sweet spot, folks. Get your butt out there, 90 minutes per week. So, you know, a half an hour, 3 times a week, brisk walking. That's cool. You could do that. Now, I will point out that there is a potential statistical confound here in that if you take a look at exercise that's self-reported, the people who are starting to get sick, starting to have, let's say, metastases that they don't know about and have deep bone pain or are starting to have problems with their energy because the cancer burden has become too great. These are individuals who are going to not feel like exercising, so they won't be getting those benchmarks. And then within the next year or two, these are the individuals who will die off. So it does tend to skew the statistics. Allowing for that, however, the correlation is not the same as cause indicator. I find it very, very difficult to believe that there can be enough adverse downside risk to walking for 90 minutes a week at a brisk pace. So, you know, get out there and move those glutes. Let's talk to Hap in Pacific Grove. Hello, Hap, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For, well, maybe 30 years, I've had a problem at night to the point where it would wake me up. My right foot feels very, very hot.
How many years?
30 years. And I've asked people, never really delved into it too deeply, but some people say it could be nerves. I don't know. But anyway, my right foot will get sort of red.
Ah, that was going to be my question. So you can see a difference.
Yeah, there is a difference.
Okay.
Yeah. And I rub lotion on it, and I rub something that's supposed to suppress itching. Mm-hmm. And
let me ask you this, Hap. Did you ever in your life have a significant injury to either your back or to your right leg? Broken leg, slip disc,
no.
Nothing like that?
No, I have varicose veins.
How old were you when this started?
In my early 50s, I guess.
In your early 50s.
I'm 77 now, 76.
Okay, well, the reason I asked about the injuries is because what you're describing sounds like a classic case of mild, what we used to call reflex sympathetic dystrophy. In very general terms, blood vessels have nerves that control them.
Uh-huh.
And the blood vessels' nerves can make them get bigger or smaller. And in general, when our blood vessels get bigger, they all get bigger in the corresponding sides of our body. So both legs, both arms. Like, for example, when we exercise. So you need more blood flow to the muscles. And if you start heating up the muscles, you need more blood flow to the skin to get rid of the heat. And so you'll notice changes in the blood vessel diameter in the body. And we can measure this. We're fully aware of how this works physiologically, have been for 5 decades or so. But if it doesn't happen evenly and one leg opens up more than the other, then you get what you're describing. And in many cases, it's actually much worse and painful. And that's when we call it complex regional pain syndrome. But basically, reflex sympathetic dystrophy is a better term because it is characterized by changes in sweating, changes in blood flow, changes in color, like you're experiencing. I know of nothing in Western or conventional medicine that would help you with this. I also would say that using Occam's razor, you've had this for 30 years. It hasn't been accelerating or generalizing, so it's just you, and it's probably going with you to your grave and not getting any worse before it does.
Oh, thanks.
But if you wanted to try to do something about it, I would try acupuncture, and I would work with an acupuncturist who knows neuroacupuncture.
Okay. You know, it does feel like perhaps the blood vessels are constricting. Doesn't bother me during the day, but when I lay down in bed at night, and it feels like blood vessels are constricting, that's what's causing more friction, so to speak, and causes the heat.
Well, could be that they're first constricting. Like, for example, with a migraine headache, what happens there is the blood vessels constrict, and then the tissues that are downstream say, wait a minute, I'm not getting enough blood flow, and they send out a chemical signal that says, open the heck up, guy. And then the guy opens up, but the blood vessel opens up too much, and then you have excess flow. So you could be having that phenomenon, absolutely, and that's part of this kind of push-pull thing that happens in the autonomic nervous system, where you have one side, the sympathetic side, that's opening up vessels, and the other, the parasympathetic side, that's closing them. And so they have this little tug-of-war going. And
okay, well, thanks very much.
Good luck to you.
I'll look into that with the acupuncture.
Yeah, look into it with acupuncture, and don't worry.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Quick email from Molly in New York, having tingling sensations in her shoulder, arm, and hand, and had an MRI which showed spinal cord impingement in three areas in her hand. Since then, I've had physical therapy and psychotherapy and mild yoga, all with the goal of trying to avoid surgery, and lately my neck has become stiff, but the tingling has subsided. Now, Molly works in advertising, translation stress, sitting, computer work, and she wants to know if there's any hope of getting better, wondering about injections, putting Botox in her neck. She's really searching for a non-surgical cure. So, first thing, Molly, is to try and define for yourself what it is that bothers you. Is it the stiffness? The tingling's gone away, so is it pain? Is it stiffness? I would strongly recommend getting your workstation looked at by a professional ergonomic person, and definitely getting up, taking frequent breaks, doing those stretches they taught you in physical therapy. And furthermore, in cases of spinal cord impingement like this, I'm not sure whether it's disc impingement or whether it's arthritis, you don't say, but I have been very pleased with the results seen with cervical traction, which can be done at home. And I had a lot of patients in my practice avoid neck surgery with the use of judicious cervical traction. And particularly for stiffness and spasm, it can be quite beneficial. And of course, as a licensed acupuncturist, I'm very interested in acupuncture as a treatment for these things, and strongly suggest you do that. Unless, and being that you're in New York and have health insurance, you'll have no problem getting a nerve conduction test. Assuming that your nerve conduction studies do not show moderate to severe damage or injury potentials in the nerve. If you've got moderate to severe damage in those nerves, then you need surgery before that damage becomes permanent. And that's a nerve conduction study that can be done by any competent neurologist, and I'm sure there's a lot of them in New York. So good luck to you. Let's go to, I'm going to give this my best respectful shot, Vigiano. Did I get your name right?
Pretty good.
Well, how do we say it?
Vigiano.
Vigiano, okay. Well,
yes, in fact, I know you from sculpture class a long time ago.
Oh, okay, hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm calling on behalf of a friend.
Oh, well, I'm glad it's not you who has the injury. Go ahead.
All right, she had a childhood injury where her spinal cord, I guess, got injured. She's 47 now, and she's suffering from severe back pain. She's on SSI because of it, or else Medi-Cal. And the pain is so severe, she's taking heavy medication, so she can't do very much, and she doesn't have any money to do anything. So I'd like to know if there's any suggestion. They said that it's scar tissue that's causing the problem, from what I'm understanding. And if they said if they went in and took out the scar tissue, it would just grow back again.
You know, it's a very...
She's having a rough...
I could see that. This is kind of a specific clinical question that before I could really give you any suggestions, I'd have to know more about, you know, what level it is, what was the nature of the initial injury, what kind...
She fell on, I guess, on her back. And
what happened internally. Like, did she break something? Did it
rupture
something?
I don't believe she broke something. I think she just misplaced something pretty badly.
What I'm saying is that it's very difficult to make a comment on whether this is a surgically amenable lesion or not without knowing what the MRI and the nerve conduction results show. But let me make a few comments about chronic pain. because that is something I could speak to without knowing the specifics of your friend's situation.
Okay.
And that is that once you've had chronic pain for a few years, there are adaptations and changes that occur in your body that tend to perpetuate the change.
Uh-huh.
And so, ironically, without meaning to, we sort of feed into that with our narcotics and with our pain medications.
Right.
But it is so difficult to look at someone who's in pain and who's, you know, got tears in their eyes and who has got a visible physical problem. It's very difficult not to just get out the pen and write more narcotics. But in doing so, you do create a kind of a loop. And the physiological adaptations that occur are best combated by movement. And that's the thing that people don't do. And then once they stop moving, it becomes more painful to move. And it's a vicious cycle. And once a person gets really deep down into that hole, it's extremely difficult to get them out. Some of the things that I would like to see under a reformed system would be access to chronic pain specialists. There are things. Go to my website, askdrdon.com, and look in the archives under interviews. There's a really good interview with a pain control specialist named Poree, P-O-R-E-E. He talks about some of the technological treatments that don't involve removing scar tissue, but involve essentially inserting a transmitter blockade so that the pain signal can't get to the brain. It interrupts the passage. This is called a spinal cord stimulator. We're getting into very high-tech stuff now with implanting deep brain stimulators, and I'm creeped out about deep brain stimulators, but I'm less worried about a spinal cord stimulator, particularly in a patient who has chronic intractable pain, where essentially if you can just block that pain, they can get moving again. And if they can get moving again, then they may be able to reduce the pain on their own.
What about the scar tissue?
I can't comment on that because I don't know enough about your scar tissue to say. But the but the spinal cord stimulator, that should not be a problem for most situations.
Right. The one question I have about scar tissue is if they went in and operated and take out the scar tissue.
You know, if they went in and took out the scar tissue, I doubt that would fix the pain.
You doubt if it would fix the pain. Okay, but that's useful information.
Yeah, I doubt it would fix the pain because the pain isn't about the scar tissue. Like I said, the pain's taken on a life of its own now.
Okay, that's very interesting.
Yeah, there's been further adaptations in her body that support and perpetuate the pain in terms of just the way her body processes information.
Uh-huh.
And you can learn about this. It's the March 25th, 2006 interview. My producer just pulled it up.
Okay, I will call my friend and tell her about this, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much.
All right,
bye-bye. Let's go to Sarah in Live Oak. Hello, Sarah. This is Dr. Motika.
Thank you. My dentist tried to reassure me that the mercury in my fillings was inorganic, so I didn't need to worry about it when he was removing it. And he wore no protective gear himself when he was removing it.
How did he remove it?
By chunks with the drill, just chunking
and
it out.
How many fillings did you have removed?
Just this one big one and then a second big one.
Two.
But 2 different weeks. A week apart.
Okay. All right. So let me start with the first premise that the mercury in your fillings is inorganic and therefore not dangerous. Yes, the mercury in your fillings is inorganic, but when you chew, you actually release small amounts of mercury gas, which can be absorbed into your fat tissues directly. And worse, and this is the one that really creeps me out about fillings, is that when the fillings are drilled like that, chunks of that mercury get into your saliva and get swallowed, unless they're very, very careful and they're sucking every bit of saliva out and all of the gas, ultimately you will get mercury into your gastrointestinal tract where the bacteria, remember those pesky bacteria that we have in our gut that are good guys and bad guys?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a number of the ones that we expect to find in the colon, like Citrobacter ferendi, will metabolize inorganic mercury and turn it into methylmercury, which is organic and does get absorbed. He's right on his chemistry, but he's wrong on his organic chemistry.
Mm.
So, yes, indeed, you do have the opportunity to absorb mercury when your fillings are removed. And I'm prepared to say this now. The American Dental Association has seriously painted itself into a corner because they're like the global warming deniers now. They've said it so many times and so vehemently, and the data just keeps accumulating to the contrary. And now they can't really reverse themselves without feeling very embarrassed. And so they're not being very scientific because the science is definitely there. We have population studies looking at mercury. We have so much data showing that, you know, the more fillings you have, the more mercury in your bloodstream, the more mercury in your fat. If you do a fat biopsy, and fat biopsy, you can't argue with fat biopsy, okay? It's like that's where mercury goes. It goes into your fat. It circulates in your bloodstream for a few days, and then it goes into fat storage. So if you happen to check a blood level the day after you've had your fillings removed, you'll see a bump in the mercury levels. So that's established. There's data that shows that. But even more important, looking at cadaver data, this is great. How do you refute this? You count the number of fillings in the person's mouth, then you do a fat biopsy, and the more fillings you have, the more mercury in your fat. In fact, it's like an order of magnitude. If you have more than 5 amalgam fillings, you have 10 times more mercury in your body fat than somebody who has no fillings. And that's taken all comers. That's basically people who end up in the morgue in, I think it was Milwaukee. So, you know, all kinds of people, all walks of life, all levels of personal hygiene and sanity. But if you end up dead, they do the fat biopsy and count your fillings. Mm-hmm. So there's irrefutable evidence that shows that mercury in fillings gets absorbed. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't say that anymore. And we have a plausible mechanism, which is the bacteria that use mercury for part of their metabolism and essentially metabolize it into methylmercury, which then gets absorbed by the humans. Methylmercury is very fat soluble. It'll just dissolve right across the cell membrane and get into the bloodstream. And some of it goes out through urine and some of it goes into fat. Mm-hmm. So your dentist is wrong about that. With all due respect, he should read something besides tracts put out by his society, maybe like the actual basic science literature.
Thank you.
Before you go, let me give you something positive to do about this, okay? Because you've now had the equivalent of, let's say, albacore tuna for 2 weeks, you know, nothing but albacore tuna, which has high levels of mercury. Mm-hmm. So now you've got a mercury load in your system. Let's just say that's true. I don't know that that's true. I don't know your system. I don't know your body. People vary a lot in their ability to excrete mercury. But for the sake of argument, what would you do if you had a mercury hit? You would go on a kind of a detoxification diet, which means you cut out your caffeine, your acetaminophen, you drop all but the most critical pharmaceutical drugs, you start juicing like crazy, lots and lots and lots of fruits and vegetables, lots of kale, cabbage, broccoli, broccoli sprouts. There are agents like N-acetylcysteine, that's an over-the-counter health food store item that will help your body get rid of mercury and restore its ability to get rid of more.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you located?
Santa Cruz.
Okay, so you could come to my Mission Street office and we could do a consultation. I could load you up with all sorts of suggestions so that you could just help yourself get rid of all of this stuff.
You have no symptoms to tell you got a mercury overload.
Oh, no, the symptoms, this is a slow accumulation and the latency in terms of symptoms is years, just like the girl with the sushi who's like eating a lot of sushi fish at her sushi restaurant.
Uh-huh.
She gets a common problem. But she's young to be getting this problem. And maybe it's just, you know, luck of the draw, or maybe her nerves are a little bit less functional because she already has this toxin load to deal
with. In terms of years, I'm 67, so maybe...
Did you ever play with mercury when you were a little kid?
No.
You never got those little balls of mercury at the dentist?
Yeah, a little bit, but not very much. Maybe once or twice, but maybe.
Yeah. Well, if you look at mercury levels in, like, teeth, which is a fairly reliable thing, and you look at 200 years ago, 100 years ago, and now, you know, everybody's got more mercury in their system because it's been released into the atmosphere. There's levels in the soil, and it's being concentrated in the ocean like crazy. That's where most of the industrial mercury is going. So, you know, we've all got a load of it, and most of us are able to tolerate it, and then there are the people who can't.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't make sense to take on more poison than you have to.
Uh-huh.
So my attitude is, if you've got it in there, don't stir it up. If you get stirred up, then try to get rid of it. Try to help your body detoxify it.
Yeah, I've got 2 more to be taken out.
Well, don't do that this year.
Oh, really?
That's
well, they're quite critical. They're holding my bridge in. They're at the base of my bridge, and it looks like they've...
Then you need to find a dentist who actually believes that this is a toxic substance and will take precautions.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good luck. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
On the subject of mercury, I was away at a conference last week. That's why we had a interview. And I picked up this little really frightening factoid, which is that in the manufacture of high fructose corn syrup, mercury is used as a catalyst. And the high fructose corn syrup then goes through a purification process in which the mercury is extracted down to the allowable level. Now, the federally mandated allowable level of mercury is high enough that it is at least theoretically possible to have in a 50-gram serving, that's 200 calories, that's basically a big gulp, 25 micrograms of mercury. Now, that's as much as is in a vaccination. So if you had a big gulp every day and the mercury levels were at the high end, at the legal limit, you'd be getting a vaccination every day. Every day, every time that you have a load of this stuff, 200 calories of it, you might be getting as much mercury as is in a vaccination. Let's think about all of those soft drink places, all of those soft drinks, all of those gas stations with the big 1 liter cup size that you're getting or that people get. And let's think about how much mercury people may potentially be getting into their systems that way. Anyway, I found it a really excellent reason to stop giving children soda. You know, end of discussion, stop giving children soda. We had an off-air question from Jim in Palo, Colorado. Had vertebra impingement on nerves and had success with a chiropractor. Let's talk a little bit. We've got a couple of minutes and only a couple of minutes. So this is a good time to talk about this chiropractic concept of subluxation and what I do with it. This is my opinion. Let's be clear. But the subluxation is where a bone gets out of place. And you hear that a lot in reference to chiropractic. Our bones in our spinal column are held together by a combination of ligaments and small, deep muscles called metaphyse. And if you move in a certain way and there's unequal weight across your spine, it is possible to jump the bones off of their straight and narrow. Now, when you do that, that puts the ligaments and the muscles on the side that's being stretched into extreme stress, and their stretch receptors start screaming. That leads to a reactive spasm. The whole body says, oh, something is really wrong. I'm just going to go into spasm and hold it all straight. And you have your classic presentation of a person who's lifting or turns their head and suddenly they have sharp, searing pain and spasm and they can't move freely anymore. Now, that's a situation where I send people to a chiropractor because that sounds like a subluxation. And a chiropractor basically learns how to manipulate these things back into place. But just like penicillin for the cold, chiropractic gets generalized. It has such a really flamboyant, dramatic improvement in that little situation that people start going back for vaguer pain, for more persistent pain, for pain that doesn't have that sudden, abrupt onset. And that's where I part ways with my chiropractic colleagues. I don't believe that everything can be managed with chiropractic. I don't believe everything can be managed with anything. That's why I have at least, you know, three disciplines under my belt, is so that I can increase the number of things I can manage. But if you have that acute sudden onset and you get manipulated and you're better, it's extremely important to understand that you would not have gotten that subluxation unless you were too loose. And so that's where core exercises, strengthening the deep muscles is really important. Anyone who's had a subluxation, whose chiropractor doesn't give them exercises, needs to find another chiropractor, because I think chiropractors who do that are just saying, ooh, ooh, I can, you know, I've got a cash cow here. That's not right. If a chiropractor is working with you properly, they're going to work with you on your diet. They're going to help you eat a less inflammatory diet. They're going to help you with strengthening exercises. They're going to have a focus on your overall health. And I know plenty of chiropractors that do exactly that and are very effective clinicians and right up there with the best that healers have to offer. So not all doctors are created equal. I think we can say that not all chiropractors are created equal, and it's important to find a good one and a reputable one. But nevertheless, I believe that it can be an extremely helpful modality, and that's the circumstance where that's my go-to guy is the chiropractor. That sudden, abrupt pain with movement. Not car accidents or falls, by the way, because then I'm worried about structural damage. Well, we've come to the end of another hour. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.